Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. Nick, you just adopted a dog named Stinky?
So not adopted, but I'm back in Idaho, getting everything settled, and a cute Australian Shepherd just kind of wanders around the backyard. And I open up the door. Clearly, it was in the river. It was cold. It was a little hungry. The most affectionate little guy, little girl, actually, I've ever seen. So I'm like, hey, you're cold, you're hungry. Come on in. I'm a great guy. Have a bite to eat, warm up. And the way she was acting, I'm like, listen, I got to get in my car here for a second. And she was like, oh, we're going for a ride in the car. And I'm like, no, you're like, you can't come with me. This is a, I'm doing a chore at the grocery store. Come back. She's still there. So I'm not quite sure that adoption is the word that I'm using. I've called the neighbors.
You were adopted by a dog.
I didn't choose this dog. This dog chose me. But yeah, Stinky's right outside and literally looking at me through the window. And I'm like, girl, like, what if you are someone's dog and they come looking and I'm just chilling in the crib with you? That owner's going to think that I'm a psycho and I'm just out here stealing dogs. So it's kind of a catch-23 situation.
Wearing a West Virginia lacrosse jersey on a Sunday afternoon, no less.
Yeah, and Stinky just scratched at the front door. What are you doing? Oh, looks like there's someone out there that might be. Oh, we're gonna have to.
All right, you gotta take a break. We'll restart this.
Yeah. What a wild start to the morning.
All right, take two on the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by a very frazzled Nick Osello, who is also just wearing a West Virginia lacrosse jersey,
and stealing
entertaining
dogs.
House guests and being rescued.
Yeah, the rundown
by dogs.
Of the morning.
I don't know how to.
Yeah, I'll touch on this for 5 seconds. But the dog just shows up. I put on my West Virginia jersey, and then the family that owns the house I'm staying at shows up. So I have to come out in a West Virginia lacrosse jersey, and they're like, "Hey, it's been a while since we've seen you. What's going on? Did you get a dog and move to West Virginia for a little bit?" And I'm like, "No, it's all this. It's don't worry about it. How are you?" So yeah, if I seem a little flustered or frazzled. Yeah. So if I seem flustered, love me when I least deserve it, because that's when I really need it, and I need a little love right here. So, oh boy.
Well, fortunately, the college lacrosse world provided with another great weekend of action, and we are going to dive right in. And Nick, as always, you prepared a tasty rundown. What's first on the menu?
The biggest program win doesn't happen very often. I feel like we saw it once, potentially with Dartmouth earlier this year. And to have it happen kind of two times in one season, I'll say is a very rare occurrence. And that being Michigan getting their first win over Maryland. And shout out, I can't remember, somebody tweeted that it was really hard to know where to rank teams in the Big Ten aside from Maryland and Michigan. Congrats to that idiot for being dead wrong, as Michigan got a 16-11 biggest win in program history. Honestly, led the way by Josh Zawada, who is sneaky, a really fun and electric player to watch, and Michael Boehm, who both had 3 and 4 goals respectively. Honestly, they jumped out to a 6-2 lead. Maryland fought back, and Michigan pulled away at the end. The biggest takeaway for me here was that you can't really describe this game as a fluke. The first highlight that I saw from this was kind of that fluky goal where there was a trail check and the ball cleared the goal line going like 3 miles an hour. So I thought it was just one of those weird games before I got a chance to see and read it. This was not a fluke. Perfect clears, great job at the faceoff X, good enough defense and enough offense to come away with a statement victory. Terry.
Got a lot to say. I mean, first of all, I agree with you in terms of Michigan just outplayed them. I think that one of the things I want to start with is the notion of greatness. And greatness is not defined by your ceiling. is defined by your average, how consistent you are. And I think that these are two teams who are inconsistent in opposite ways. Maryland has struggled against some of the worst teams that it has played so far this season. Michigan has played its best against some of the best teams that it's played this season and has played poorly against some of the worst teams that they played. And so in this game, it was a little bit of Maryland overlooking the Wolverines as well as Michigan getting up to play the Terrapins. And, you know, this is going to sting a little, so I apologize. But the pace and flow of this game reminded me a lot of Virginia's win over Notre Dame in the sense that Maryland cut it... Yeah, catching strays 10 days later. In the sense that Michigan built a lead. Maryland brought it all the way back. I don't know whether they actually tied it. It was 7-6. It was 11-9. And then from the 10-minute mark to the 42nd mark of the fourth quarter, they just separated and pulled away. Virginia's window in which they did that was a lot narrower. But when it comes down to trying to analyze this game, you know, I think that I start by saying putting up 16 on Maryland is more significant and impressive than holding them to 11, at least in this year's version of these teams. And I didn't think that it was a function of goalie play. Brian Ruppel made 13 saves, and I thought that he was just as good as you would have expected him to be. Despite the fact that Justin Weifelt was awesome, he was 12 of 15 at the faceoff. Basically, they were 50-50, which is a win against Luke Wehrman, and it prevents Maryland from being able to strangle possession, but it's also not really a reason that they won, right? They didn't win because they dominated the faceoff X. I actually thought that it was a little odd that Michigan kept going back to Nick Rowlett when so many of Weifelt's wins were being followed by good things that happened, but you know, they were in a 2-2-2-2-2 pattern and just kind of stuck to it, and it wasn't until late that it became clear how disparate the results actually were. So for me, you know, I look at this and I say, how did Michigan get to 16? And you know, I think that if you were a Maryland fan who was critical, you could be critical of the matchup approaches, particularly putting Ajax Zapatello on Josh Zawada as opposed to Brett Makar. And the reason I feel that way is because when Zawada has struggled against elite competition over the course of the last couple of years, it's been when he was physically overpowered, not when folks tried to match feet and take the ball away and do all the other things that Zapatello is really, really good at. If these two teams meet again, I would expect to see that switch, and I would expect to see Makar really try to get into Zawada's head early. You know, and then when you looked at Makar, he did do a nice job containing Ryan Cohen, but obviously Michigan can be successful even without it. And you've heard me talk about Mike Boehm on this podcast for the last 2 years. You know, he's my favorite player in college lacrosse, not only because we went to the same high school and because I played with his older brother, but also because he's 5'7", 150 pounds, and he causes like a turnover or two, like 1.5 turnovers a game as an attackman, and picks up like 2.5 ground balls a game. I mean, the ability to affect the game outside of just scoring and assisting is outrageous. But he also, in my opinion, does a great job at controlling the tempo, the when to go type aspects of their approach. And, you know, all of this is to say that they don't score 16 goals without Josh Wada playing what I thought was his best game in a moment like this. Now, it's also not the first time he's played well in a big game this year. He has shown progress, but in some of those prior games, either they were against lesser competition or they didn't win. This was, in my opinion, a little bit of a turning point moment. And then at the other end of the field, you know, obviously they trotted out two goalies, so they weren't fully pleased with the performance that Shane Carr put in, even though, you know, I thought he made some nice stops. And overall, you know, defensively, they did exactly what they needed to do in order to put themselves in a position to win a Big Ten conference matchup on the road, respond from a disappointing loss against Johns Hopkins a week ago, in which they felt like they outplayed the Blue Jays at home. So, you know, now they go back, and we're recording this on Sunday afternoon as Penn State's currently 16-8 lead over Ohio State with 3.5 minutes to go winds down. You're going to have four teams in the Big Ten that are 1-1, one team that's 2-0 in the Johns Hopkins Blue Jays, and another team in Rutgers that's 0-2, which I don't think, as your previously unidentified tweeter alluded to, you would have picked before the season started.
So an interesting thing that I want you to expand further on is the idea that it was a matchup, almost that played a big role, and it wasn't playing in Maryland's favor throughout the game. Is it fair to say that on the scale of we don't care who we're playing, we have our game plan and we're going to stick to it no matter what, to we need to switch matchups after one goal is scored? Do you think that Maryland was almost stubborn in their persistence on staying on those matchups?
Yes and no. You know, I thought that they were pretty willing to get John Geppert onto Bame. So I guess my point is, like, I don't know that they felt like they needed or even had better options than the ones they were utilizing. I think that ultimately, because Makar was doing a good job on Cohen, you had to wonder whether making that switch was going to potentially unlock him, and then what the cascading effects were. I'll probably use this analogy later on in the podcast a second time, but it's kind of like when an offensive lineman gets injured and you're in the NFL and you've got, you know, seven or eight offensive linemen on your team and you don't have a left guard. So you want to move your right guard to left guard, your center to right guard, and then you put in your backup center, right? Like, now you have impacted three guys' responsibilities as opposed to, you know, just replacing that left guard on a one-for-one basis. So I think that that's what they would have had to have done as opposed to just switching Zapatello and Makar. And so as a result, it would have been too disruptive to the scheme. And again, like, I think the game flow is really important to understand. With 50 minutes into the game, this looked like a pretty normal Michigan played well, Maryland played poorly, but they closed better and won the game. It was so, you know, if you're Maryland and you were had a historically great season last year, you know, you've already had your troubling seas moments early in the year. It felt like you righted the ship. You lost to Notre Dame in three overtimes. You beat Virginia. You have earned the confidence in your own ideas, your own plans, your own thoughts, your own opinions to move forward with them and be faithful. And especially when you're trailing by two goals with 10 minutes to go, it's like, yeah, we're going to win this game. It's not justifiable to really, I guess, overreact is probably the best way of putting it. So what's interesting is now, how do you change your approach coming away from it? You know, on that spectrum, like you talked about, Where does the development of a second plan, third plan type thing fall? You know, and that's also not to say that they didn't change some aspects of their approach. It's just to say that, you know, in terms of the whole of the game, that was kind of my assessment of how the matchups played out. And then the other side of the coin, I always feel like I need to provide this caveat, and you can, you know, shine. You made an excellent point 2 weeks ago when you talked about, I believe it was the Denver Ohio State game, just in terms of special teams, right? Like, you know, I didn't get the sense that extra man and transition had an undue effect on their ability to get to 16. But, like, when we talk about those two aspects and then you talk about switching, it's like, all right, well, we have our plan from a matchup standpoint. And, you know, a disproportionate amount of the production came when we got away from our plan as it was. So it's even more, you know, motivation or reinforcement not to adjust what you want to do.
Yeah, and it's interesting, the game that I called the San Diego game, they had five shorthanded penalties, which, like, just kind of goes to reinforce the point that you're finding ways to win outside of the game plan. That type of momentum is more noticeable than a well-executed 6-on-6 offense. Like, I'd much rather have, oh, we weren't expecting to have unreal production from X, as opposed to we executed the game plan very well. There's just a little extra zhuzh that comes along with, you know, guys that don't typically scoring, all that kind of stuff. Zhuzh, je ne sais
quoi. Especially when you're the underdog in a game like that.
Exactly. So moving on to the next game. And Terry, you were a history major, right? I think you mentioned that.
I did mention that.
Good call, because the history of this rivalry is actually, I don't even want to call it a rivalry because you need it to be competitive. There's something that Duke just steals Virginia's lunch. I don't know what it is. any time of day, any time of place, any season. And on a rainy day, it was Brendan O'Neill who was the ultimate difference maker, having 9 points and the overhit in a 16-14 victory. And this is another game that I feel was semi came down to strategic matchups. Kenny Brower did a great job versus Schellenberger, and they let unnamed scumbag short stick Dimitis take Cormier. Cormier had six, but it seemed more intentional to take away Schellenberger and his ability to, you know, kind of break down defenses from behind the cage, and just said, we'll take Cormier scoring six. Duke led throughout the game, nursing various kind of 3 to 5 goal leads. But ultimately they own Virginia. And what do you got?
Excellent summary right there. I think that you hit on the most pertinent points. I feel compelled to kind of work from the position of you know, I'm not going to, you know me well enough to know that I'm not going to take a victory lap, and I'm not going to thump my chest about all the criticism that came my way for voting Duke number one this week. I would never do that. That being said, I do feel like I'm going to start from the position of how nervous I was over the course of the game that Virginia was going to pull off this comeback and close it out. I wouldn't have said that Duke was going to be able to win this game and that they were going to get to 16 goals without more production from Andrew McAdory. But what was interesting was how incredible he was in the 10-man clear and how perfect he is as an attackman with the midfielder's ability to then drop over the midline, pick the ball out, and then I wrote this. So McAdory played in our Midnight Mania event as a rising junior, right? So it was September of 2019, and we were in Chase Fieldhouse, which is an indoor complex in Wilmington, Delaware, and he was playing this game, and I'd seen him play a ton. He was, you know, a very well-known player in high school. But for whatever reason, this moment will stick with me forever. There, he was leading a break in transition, but it was a 4-on-5. So there wasn't really anything there. But he's still dangerous on the slow break, so I was just curious to see what he was going to do. And so you know, he was between his own his defensive restraining box in the midline and the offensive players who were dropping back were between the midline and the offensive restraining line. And I mean, it was like a scene out of the Fast and the Furious. The nitrous oxide that this guy pressed and how fast he went from, you know, basically the 40-yard line to the opposing 30-yard line was the fastest I've literally ever seen. And so ever since then, you know, I've wondered, how do you best utilize his skill set? Particularly because he is such a pass-first player. He's such a good facilitator. Now, when he was playing with Crush and he was playing with Xavier Arline, Brendan O'Neill, and Joey Spallina, he was doing it from the midfield. And so it was easy to imagine what that would look like. But we've talked for 2 or 3 years about Duke's need for a facilitator that was going to understand how to get Brendan O'Neill and Dyson Williams, two lefties, involved. And this year, it felt to me like McAdory was the skeleton key that had figured out that otherwise very difficult challenge that they themselves, as a program, had failed to fully figure out. So that ability to turn the corner and score, or just move the ball, find the open guy. It's awesome, and it's really important and really valuable. But at the same time, the thing that he showed in this game that was so special was that midfielder's speed and how helpful it was against the 10-man ride and what Duke was able to do, you know, because in a game that was played on an ice rink, if they were as inefficient clearing as a lot of teams are against Virginia's 10-man ride, it could have been trouble. And so as a result, you know, for me, that was kind of a sneaky difference. You're right to call out Brower, particularly because, you know, Duke thinks he has played Schellenberger very well when they have met as a Duke-UVA matchup, but also dating back to when they covered each other in club lacrosse as well. And because of that viral clip of Kenny slipping behind the goal a couple years ago, the perception is that he doesn't guard Schellenberger well. And they don't think that's true. So, you know, the last element is just this short-sticking Cormier thing. And you know, Cormier's early season preference, for lack of a better way of putting it, of dodging, essentially. And, you know, as an interior finisher over the course of his career leading up to this point, who then, you know, should have a role in the two-man game, particularly with Thomas McConvey because of their built-in chemistry. I don't know. When he was out injured, Virginia's ball movement and flow continued to look as good as it did or look even better. And so you start to wonder, is Peyton Cormier a little bit of a ball stopper? And then I think the question becomes, is that a trap that Virginia will allow themselves to fall into? And then Duke employs this strategy. And, you know, there's probably some confirmation bias because they were talking about it a lot on the broadcast relative to the fact that Virginia still got to 14 goals, right? It wasn't, this game wasn't won because their offense wasn't productive enough, or wasn't lost, excuse me. But all the, you know, kind of all the way around, if Connor Schellenberger was going punch for punch with Brandon O'Neal, you probably would have felt better about being able to make a play down the stretch that would ultimately decided a close game in your favor. As it was, even though you always felt like Duke was potentially going to lose grip on the game, Virginia was never able to actually throw a punch that got them all the way back into the game.
I'm curious, because now we've seen a little bit of this roulette with Duke, Notre Dame, Maryland, Virginia. Is this performance from Duke the best that you've seen out of these top tier matchups? Cornell has not played. They lost to Penn State, I think, is their best matchup. So we'll omit them from the top four. So if you have a stink about me not including Cornell, go to the mirror and cry. So was this the performance that you think maybe separates Duke and has them as the clear favorite for the national champion?
Well, they're not the clear favorite for the national champion, because if there are four teams that are roughly equivalent in contention, then you're just going to continue to see this four-card Monty over the course of the rest of the season, and then certainly matchups are going to matter in terms of the NCAA tournament as well. I think that you can answer the question in two ways. The first is Maryland's performance against Virginia was probably the highest relative to what you might have expected, based on what they had done to that point. Now, obviously, you know, they had played Notre Dame close. We've already hashed and rehashed this. I just think that from my standpoint, you know, the gap between what I expected to see from Maryland and what I saw against Virginia relative to what I expected to see from Duke against Virginia and what I saw was just a little bit wider. But I think ultimately Virginia played better against Duke on Friday than they did against Maryland. Marginally, not significantly. And so as a result, yes, I would say that Duke's win over Virginia so far is the best performance of the season. But I don't think that they have like the second, third, and fourth best performances. So it's not as if they, you could say that, you know, one of the other teams has the second and third best performance, and as a result, it's even better, right? So I think that that's hedging and hemming and hawing and dodging the question, but at the same time, it's the way I feel. Speak my truth.
Got it. Well, it was just the only reason I was asking is because it kind of made it seem like the ability to initiate and get O'Neal and Williams the ball, it almost made it seem like that was the final to rip out of Anish Sharaf's Marvel comparisons. That was the final Infinity Stone for Duke. Good non-answer. You know, you're soft for not taking a stance and dying on a hill that is arbitrary, but that's where I come in. I think Notre Dame's the favorite. And speaking of two segues here, speaking of me thinking Notre Dame's going to be the favorite, and we talked about how Duke just steals UVA's lunch, there is not an easier victory for Notre Dame than going to the Syracuse Dome, slapping him around a little bit, and leaving with a victory. It's just been pure domination the last couple years. This game was particularly close, as it was 20-12. I think 2012 was the year that the Mayans predicted the world to end. However,
that's correct.
I think there was just predicting the closest game Syracuse is ever going to have with Notre Dame. Now, this game comes down to one thing, really, and one thing only. Notre Dame jumps out to
the lead.
Hold
on, before you move on from that, though. Hold on. I'm sorry. Let me derail you for a second, because when you get away from the history, you're going to kill my point. So we were talking about biggest win in Michigan's program history. They had Maryland on the ropes in 2016. They lost 8-7. Maryland scored with, about 40 seconds left. Isaiah Davis Allen scored a man-up goal earlier in the game, which was something that I don't think had ever been said prior to that. You know, it was a similar game in the sense that Maryland got out to a lead and basically just tried to kind of white-knuckle it the rest of the way. But the reason I bring it up in the context of Notre Dame Syracuse is because I watched it in the Carrier Dome, press box before Notre Dame spoiled Syracuse's 100th year anniversary of the program by beating them 17-7 in the Carrier Dome, which might have been kind of the game that got this whole thing rolling.
Yes, very relevant point. That was the first time, and that was kind of fresh out of college for me. I had some Syracuse buddy, you know, some Syracuse alums, and that was the first truly. It was a hybrid between a piano recital and a tap dancing performance on the graves of the Syracuse alum on their 100-year anniversary. But the story of this game goes to one thing and one thing only. The brief reminder, Notre Dame jumped out to a lead, Syracuse made it close, and in the ever-important momentum, it came down to one call. Liam Enemann stops the ball clearly, and the momentum of the ball, and it's in his stick, goes across the goal line, clear as day. Anybody with a brain, anybody with working eyes can see that it was a save. Some people were arguing that it was a goal. From that moment, Notre Dame, and particularly Will Lynch, went on an absolute tear of faceoffs, goals, and they used that momentum to completely run away with it in the fourth quarter. But again, on Twitter, if you're watching the game, everybody was pissed off about this goalie save. And if that goal went in, credit to Syracuse, it would have been a 7-point blowout loss. So one of the greatest what-ifs of our generation. What's your opinion on this save? I want to hear it.
Clearly no one knows that the rule is if the ball is in the goalie's stick and crosses the goal line, it is not a goal. I will concede I was a goalie. I did not know that that was the rule. I think that anybody trying to argue from the TV broadcast whether the ball was in his stick before or after it crossed the goal line is not arguing in good faith. And all that being said, I agree with the premise of your point, which is that I have argued that pivotal plays like that change the tenor of games dramatically. One that actually stands out is another play from 2016 in the semifinals. North Carolina blew the doors off of Loyola. There was a loose ball push call at the midline when the ball was coming over the midline. I think the game was like 3-1. I don't remember what I don't know who was winning at the time, and I don't really remember the circumstances too well. But I think Loyola got called for a push and Carolina scored, and then the route was on. It was like they scored 11 straight goals and it was a total blowout on route to a national championship. So, like, I have argued that those types of plays can swing a game as dramatically as what we saw in the Notre Dame Syracuse game. So it would be in bad faith for me to say that it wasn't a hugely impactful play, but it didn't feel like it to me in the moment. You know, the way that, to your point, Notre Dame controlled the faceoff from that point on felt like, even though it was a confusing call, it wasn't the reason that the game ended the way that it did.
Yeah, it's tough because I inherently agree, and me agreeing with that this moment impacted the game far more than a lot of other, you know, single moment instances throughout the season works against my narrative that Notre Dame would have absolutely slapped around Syracuse regardless of if that was a goal or not. What was interesting though was seeing kind of peak Notre Dame fourth quarter Syracuse versus Notre Dame was everything that I wanted to see. A great performance from the faceoff, a complete rout, and honestly, we talk about moments on like piecing things together. You know, you take a really good job by, you know, anything, Duke's offense. You take individual instances. Hopkins at the first game of the season when they had to go through their entire depth on midfield and come away with a victory. I love that now because Notre Dame had that rout in the fourth quarter, that gives them the confidence to never consider themselves either out of a game or that they're never going to be able to catch up and hold a team underwater and close things out, meaning that if they're down two goals, if they're up one, if it's a close situation, if there's time left on the clock, they now have a great reference point to take confidence into whatever situation moving forward from a face-off perspective, from a punches and bunches perspective, and from a, you know, just controlling the game in every aspect. So didn't really matter. I don't want to say this because it takes away from how important the games are to the players, but objectively speaking, a lot of the games moving forward don't matter once you kind of have it locked up. You're fighting, you know, Duke Notre Dame is going to be fantastic from an entertainment standpoint. As far as the impact it's going to have on playoffs and college lacrosse, minimal. Both teams are going to be very good. Both teams are going to coast to the playoffs. So cherry picking moments like that that you can take to relevant points that are going to happen in the playoffs was the personal takeaway from me.
No, I mean, it's actually a really good segue into the games that we're going to talk about coming up right now, because this is such a weird point in the season where the stakes feel so high because now everybody's playing league games, and these are the games that determine whether or not you get into the conference tournament, and then your performance in the conference tournament is what determines whether or not you get into the NCAA tournament. But at the same time, for as important as the games feel, in many respects, they are very unimportant in the sense that momentum changes so dramatically on a week-to-week basis. And what we have seen over the last 3 weeks is that losing is the best advantage. It is the leading indicator of whether or not you're going to win the following week. So as a result, like, you know, in this game in particular, it's a little bit more challenging in the sense that if you're Syracuse and you beat Notre Dame, that is a NCAA tournament bolstering resume win. And it is also almost a program changer. And I don't mean it obviously in the context of 107 years of history, but in terms of where this is in the Gary Gate era, it was 3 weeks ago that you asked me what Syracuse needs to do in order to accomplish X. I don't remember whether it was win a championship or qualify for the tournament or whatever. And my comment was wait until next year, right? And I know that some people found that funny. I'm sure that some people on staff and particularly the seniors on the team did not find it very funny. But my point is that, like, this team is who we thought they were. There is very little about 2023 Syracuse that is surprising. They are better than they were last year, and you can clearly see the path forward. But as far as what they're going to be able to do this year, like, they're just not going to be able to beat Notre Dame, Duke, and Virginia, right? And so the point is, if there is any takeaway, like acute takeaway of this game for me, it is, why did it take Notre Dame so long to separate from the Orange? And I attribute it to a couple of factors. I mean, they were the ones coming off the loss, so they should have been motivated. But at the same time, they probably didn't think Syracuse could play with them. So I would assume that that is possible in terms of attributing to a slow start. But ultimately, what it comes down to is, like, you know, Notre Dame couldn't really afford to lose this game because it is threatening to be a bad loss. But at the same time, like, had they lost it and then they turned around and beat Virginia, or, you know, beat Duke at home and then beat Virginia a week later, like, you know, this game's so far in the rearview mirror by mid to late April, it doesn't matter. Let's get to the next games because I think it'll help me make my point even more clear.
And we have a pair of conference upsets, Utah over Jacksonville and Navy over Boston. So we'll start with Utah and harnessing the power of Drew Wasserman's older brother, Bryce. They had an offensive performance in 18-15 win and are now 4-0 in conference play. The story to me was Utah punched first and they punched hard to the point where it was almost over from the start. And 18-15 almost is not representative of how close this game was, because in going into halftime, it was 13-5. And it honestly, it felt further away than that sounds. And it's weird because Jacksonville's only loss was to Hopkins. They've been on, all things considered, a pretty good tear, albeit close games against...
They beat Duke.
I don't want to say lesser opponents. Yeah, they beat Duke. Things are going great for them, and now they take a step backwards. Help me understand why this happened.
So it's hard for me not to just say that it's the schedule, in the sense that Jacksonville had to go from home to Cleveland, and they, you know, held on against the Vikings of Cleveland State on Wednesday, and then on to Salt Lake City. Like, here's kind of my point. The First of all, the A-Sun is unlike any conference we've ever seen in college lacrosse, even the GWLL. The Great Western Lacrosse League, which featured Denver, Air Force, Notre Dame, Fairfield, Quinnipiac. Then it became the ECAC, and it added Loyola, and you know, was a very wide collection and wild collection of teams. Didn't have 10 members, and as a result, didn't have teams playing 9 games. So as a result, like, the fact that they're playing 9 games is so substantial, because what it means is you essentially have like half your season, and then you have to do these midweek games where you would fly from Jacksonville to Cleveland to Salt Lake City. And it's just, I mean, it's like an NBA schedule. It's crazy. So I think that's so hard to overstate how impactful it is, because we've just never seen it before, and it will create unpredictability. And I think on Wednesday, you saw that with Mercer beating Bellarmine and Detroit Mercy beating Robert Morris. And then on Saturday, Detroit Mercy goes to Queens, who had just lost at Lindenwood, a game that I was at on Wednesday. And Detroit Mercy, who had just beaten Robert Morris, who won the A-Sun last year, loses at Queens. So, like, the unpredictability from top to bottom is very clear and very present. Now, to the point about this not mattering that much, like, so 6 teams make the A-Sun tournament. It's going to be at Robert Morris. My assessment is that, you know, Utah, like, they just by virtue of winning, right, they get the number one seed and whatever that means from a seeding standpoint. Like, Jacksonville's now in a position where they had some pressure lifted off them. They had been playing poorly leading up to, I mean, you're right, like, they survived some close games against some inferior opponents, and that's good. It deserves some credit, particularly in the circumstances that I just described in terms of travel. But at the same time, it's a far cry from who they were last year. This was the number 2 or number 3 defense in the country last year. And, you know, they bring back some of the pieces, particularly, you know, some good short stick D middies and a goalie in Luke Milliken. But, you know, in losing Colin Hinton specifically, but then I believe, I think it was Dixon Smith, and apologies if I got that wrong, you know, a handful of really important poles. This is a completely different defense from who they were last year. Offensively, they're pretty similar. It's kind of the same in the sense that they lost their middies like Jeremy Winston and a couple of other initiators like that. You know, but they bring back their 3 starting attackmen. They added Dylan Watson, and then they added Brandon Galloway, who, you know, for me was playing almost like an All-American in terms of offensive midfielders through the first part of the season. So personnel wise, there isn't a ton of difference. Production wise, it's pretty substantial. This defense is in the 20s. It's not number 2 or number 3. And that was the difference between last year's team and this year's team. And that's why, you know, I picked Utah last year to beat Jacksonville, and that didn't go well. But this year, the opposite happened, and it's because these two teams are a little bit more similar in terms of their analytics, whereas, you know, last year Jacksonville was a pretty substantial outlier. So, you know, there's just a lot here, right, in terms of scheduling dynamics, the A-Sun in particular, how good Jacksonville actually is. And the only thing that we haven't really gotten to is how good Utah is. And, you know, for me, I'm going to be slow on Utah this year because it's going to be hard to shake the memory of how much they struggled against Denver. You know, Denver was coming off of, or no, I'm sorry, it was their first game of the season. But I had, you know, pretty low expectations for Denver. And then they lost to Air Force the following week. So for me, that had a compounding effect of, you know, having comparatively high expectations for Utah. And they came out of the gate slow. Clearly, they're playing better now. They're 4-0 in the A-Sun. They're in control. They're in the driver's seat. But at the same time, they're going to have to go on the road. And as we've seen this week, traveling the A-Sun is difficult. And we'll see what it ends up meaning for the Utes.
We should come up with a statistic. And I know just the person to do it, Patrick McEwen. How the number of miles you travel, and its outcome or its impact on win predictability. Cause you know, it's the classic old, oh, we don't care. We can travel, who can travel well, this and that. But again, this A-Sun, just looking at where teams are going to have to go on a consistent basis, logging those miles is not easy. The only people who probably have it worse is Notre Dame. You know, historically underserved Notre Dame, having to take a bus to Chicago for damn near every single away game. But we're not going to get into that because we have the second pair of
conference. No, the only people that have it worse are Nick Osello when he goes on his MCLA training tour that we talked about last week.
Oh, man, that's going to be so fantastic. I want to do round two of that, and I want to talk to you offline. But anyways, we're not riffing bits or talking about business ideas. We're talking about Navy winning over Boston. So Utah wins 18-15. What an offensive shooting. Hey, everybody relax. Let's get to a 10-8 victory. And honestly, a less offensively exciting battle. However, the goal of the weekend and the potential goal of the year is Toker scooping up the ball, swarmed by the entire Boston, by the entire city of Boston that traveled to Annapolis. Dodges like three checks in an elephone, in a phone booth, throws it behind the back over his head, hybrid with his back towards the goal. Honestly, a fantastic goal. And what's awesome is that it was a big moment as well. In a 10-8 game, every goal matters, and that completed his hat trick and made it 7-5 in the fourth quarter. Max Hewitt and Tommy Hovivian both had ones as well, and when it's that low scoring, a lot of it comes down to just individual performances, and those three having hat tricks plus a good day at the X from Anthony Hobriel, I feel made all the difference when Boston wasn't able to get anything going offensively.
Yeah, and here's, you know, I think that there are some similarities between the Terriers and the Dolphins in the sense that they, you know, hadn't been playing particularly well and were a little bit vulnerable or a little bit ready to get gotten. You know, if you look at them recently, obviously, you know, their win over Harvard kind of stood out in the positive direction. But then the, you know, Crimson follow that up with a loss to Dartmouth. So, you know, when you dig into their prior games and they weren't dominant in wins over Lafayette and Bucknell, you can start to wonder, all right, how good is this team actually, particularly when, you know, you're kind of like Jacksonville carrying the, for lack of a better way of putting it, success of last year as part of it. And you're giving them credit for who they were last year. And they deserve it, right? Because those players are back. But the dynamic is different. The vibe is different. And, you know, everybody wants to beat you is essentially what it comes down to. Navy is always hard to play at. People talk about it all the time. And the trip, right? You know, Boston to Annapolis, not a tough trip when you're talking about Jacksonville to Cleveland to Salt Lake City. But still, when you're talking about a team that it's probably the only time that they're going to get on a plane this year, you can understand why or how, you know, it would have an effect. And Friday night in Navy Marine Corps Stadium against a Navy team that couldn't be more desperate. I mean, just rife to get gotten for sure.
And maybe that's another factor we need to take into is amount of miles traveled on win predictability versus the amount of miles traveled relative to your traveling schedule. Normal. I don't know how we would do that.
Yeah.
You know, did Boston use 80% of their travel mileage in one game and come away with a loss? Who knows? Either way, no one has it harder than Notre Dame. That being said, I want to hear more. So you were at the Lindenwood game, right? You were out in the lovely St. Louis, Missouri. I want to hear more about that.
So when news broke that Lindenwood was transitioning from Division II to Division I, Quint tweeted, Terry Foy is going to be out there all the time because it's really close to where my parents live. And it was funny. I am not the D2 guy at Inside Lacrosse. That's Matt Kinnear. So I had known that the women's team won a national championship and that the men's team had made pretty significant strides. But it wasn't until he told me that he had interviewed the coach, whose name is Jimmy Lang, that the dots started to come together. My brother coached high school lacrosse the year after he graduated for, I don't know, 15 years or so until his kids got too old and stopped. The first season he coached a freshman team, Jimmy played for him. It was also my freshman year of high school. So when I was on spring break, we went to visit my brother for Easter. I actually practiced with them. I don't even know if that was legal. So hopefully there's no 20-year statute of limitations on this. but I remember thinking, like, this kid's awesome. He's definitely the best player on the team. So they only have four home games this year. We got to talk about coaches doing right by new programs in terms of giving them road games, and all four home games are conference games, and two of them were this week. So it became very clear and obvious that, if I was going to go to Linden or go to St. Louis during the lacrosse season, which I've never done, I typically don't travel, you know, basically at all from like February 1st through the end of July for anything other than lacrosse. So I was like, if I'm going to do this, which is kind of making up for the fact that Southwest canceled Christmas and hadn't seen my parents since the fall, then this was the perfect week to do it. So they hosted Queens on Wednesday, and they hosted Bellarmine on Saturday. And it's incredible. I had never been to the campus before. I had driven close enough to be able to see the stadium, sort of. And it was impressive, but I didn't realize exactly how impressive it was until, you know, I actually went to a game, then went back on Friday and got a tour, and then went back for another game. The way I would describe it is if you have been to High Point, it is High Point without all the bells and whistles, which basically means without the pools, like, that you're supposed to, like, you know, I don't know, get a tan at. But it's very recently constructed. It's kind of a combination of the old side and the new side. Like television production studio and, you know, the auditorium, just like it, all the things that are very, you know, it's not vocational in the sense that, you know, you go to a trade school in order to learn a vocation. It's professional in the sense that you go to these places and you get more hands-on experience with the thing that you want to do, you know, post-graduation. They've invested tremendously in sports. You know, they've gone from, this was a school that was effectively bankrupt in the late 80s and was purchased for $1. And through the leadership of one president from like the early 90s through the mid 2000s, and then a second president, and now they're on to their third, who was an executive at IBM, you know, has basically, they've spent like $450 million in construction, and they still have, they've grown their endowment by $150 million. And I don't know if this is true, but I was told that they don't have any debt, which is insane if that is in fact the case. I need to learn how they drove the revenue and income that they actually did. And
do you know my connection with Lindenwood?
No, lay it on me.
I have. So you mentioned the women winning a national championship. That team was led by Maddie Osello.
Oh my God.
Or she might have graduated. I can't remember. My cousin played at Lindenwood. Now you might be thinking, wow, that's a connection. Why don't I just go ahead and double down on that? Because in their great existence in, I don't know the years he played, but he was, my guess would be 2015 to 19. Dustin Osello was on the men's team. I've had two cousins that have gone to Lindenwood, and I think you nailed what the big takeaway, and perhaps the most relevant part of Lindenwood, is they have a goose on campus that attacks students and people that walk on a particular path. And this is like a goose that is protected like by law. So my uncle, Dino Osello, great guy. One of the best
guys
ever.
Making another appearance on the podcast.
Another appearance. He's walking down the path. This goose starts to attack him. And he's like getting ready to kill it. You know, he's from Montana. He's a tough guy. He's like, all right, this goose is attacking me. I'm going to win. And this goose is going to die. A lot of students, and by a lot, probably like three or four, started screaming at him, don't touch that goose, like, let it go, like, you can't do anything. So as far as Lindenwood goes, to see the growth and, you know, from them being bankrupt to now, you know, fantastic. Their athletic facilities are fantastic. They treated both my cousins very well. And the goose is alive and well, attacking innocent passerbys to this day. So overall, looks like we got a little Lindenwood fandom from the Tailgate podcast.
No doubt. Support to the program for sure. The one thing I gotta bring up is the AutoZone. Have you ever been to Lindenwood?
Yeah.
Okay. The AutoZone is like an actual landmark. It's so funny because it's like the one thing that's on the property that won't sell. And so like literally the directions to get to the stadium are like, turn left at the AutoZone. It's so perfect. And that's why like it really is High Point in Missouri, because it's like Missourifying like this institution that, you know, is really appealing and has a ton going for it. But at the same time, like, yeah, you got to turn left at the AutoZone in order to get in.
Oh, I love it. Lax House Party's bump too. So shout out Lindenwood.
I have no
for
doubt
Missouri
about that. Their student housing
point
situation is ridiculous.
Dude, it's unbelievable.
I've never seen
so
the single family homes, 4-bedroom with a driveway as a student house.
Oh, fantastic. And then, so rounding out, we'll move on from the Lindenwood, you know, the Lindenwood fanatics here. Some quick conference roundup. Penn beats Yale. I thought something notable was that this is probably not Yale's finest year, and Penn acted like they just won the Super Bowl. Providence over Marquette. Marquette is putting together a wildly confusing season, and that caused a little confusion in the Big East. And in the A-10, UMass over High Point, St. Joe's over Richmond. What do the numbers mean? What do they mean? What do these matchups mean?
Well, so in the A-10 and Big East, like, essentially, we don't know, because the one that you didn't mention was Georgetown's win over Denver, and I guess the point is that, like, all four of those results would probably be what you would expect, but at the same time, as we've just seen in the Big Ten, wait until they play a week and see whether or not those things turn, because it seems very realistic or very plausible that that could be what happens. You know, all it takes is one upset, and you find, you know, an unexpected team at 2-0, and an unexpected team at 0-2, and then four teams at 1-1. So in terms of what does it mean, you know, in the context of those two in particular, I think that's what it means. In terms of what it means for the Ivy League, like, I mean, it means Yale's back's against the wall. They have Dartmouth, Brown, and Harvard, and if they lose any of those three games, their season is over, and they will not go to the NCAA tournament, which would have been a pretty shocking thing to say, you know, for having a month to go in the season. So that being said, you know, I think that there are some positives that you can take away by virtue of the fact that, you know, they righted some elements of the ship offensively against the Quakers, not defensively, right? This was a team in a game that should have been the get-right game for the defense, not for the offense, based on the way the Penn had played so far this season, you know, based on some of their injury limitations with no Dylan Gurgar and everything else along those lines. So, you know, it's down for me to the point where it's not just about, like, their inability to, you know, keep goal totals down. It's also about their inability to control leads. So, you know, there's something going on there that needs to be examined. And then, you know, elsewhere in the Ivy League, Cornell doubled up Dartmouth, and Princeton beat Brown by 3. So, you know, Harvard got a win over Colgate out of conference. So, you know, the status quo was more or less maintained in the Ivy League, and we have our expectations set in the A-10 and the Big East, and now we just need to wait to see them get pivoted.
Got it. I think that does it for the lacrosse talk. And do you have a good guy of the week or a notable cause that you want to talk to, or is this just going to be on my shoulders every week?
No, I mean, I think Lindenwood is my good guy of the week. We already talked about it. So Jimmy Lang, appreciate Lindenwood. Your hospitality. Appreciate you showing me around. They're my good guy of the week.
Two good guys, one funny, one serious. Good guy of the week is West Virginia. Thanks for sending me this jersey. I'm rocking the Mountaineers jersey. And it was funny because I had to go say hello to the family whose house I'm staying at. And they're like, what's going on? Why are you doing this? So I got to hype up West Virginia a little bit. And then the other more serious one is there is a GoFundMe that's now going for Brett Masakai, who is a grad student at CUI, the Golden Eagles out in California. We're getting ready to do some charitable fundraising for him with Second Slide in the Post Game and a couple other, you know, random things I'm dealing with. So I wanted to bring that up on the tailgate here. Sometimes the toughest things in life are the hands you're dealt, and what you got to do is rely on the communities that you're a part of. I've always been blown away by how good the lacrosse community steps up in times like these. I believe the entire team shaved their head, which led for a beautiful pregame national anthem moment of we're all in this together. So I'm going to be promoting it on my personal Twitter. You'll be seeing kind of the things I'm doing to bring it to attention. And honestly, you know, one of our lacrosse brethren is Delta Tough Hand. Let's step up and help them out. Whether it's with promoting it, whether it's with donating it yourself, everything matters. So we got
Nick,
you, Brett.
That comment reminds me of a quote that I read from the comedian Mike Birbiglia a few years ago when he said, the world has a surplus of cleverness, but heart is in short supply. And I think that there are too many people who, those who have a sour taste for Nick Osello are those who fixate on his desire for cleverness and overlook the heart that he so frequently brings to the table. So
no,
good on you
it.
For caring about your good guy of the week.
And I got nothing else.
I love you.
I love you too, Terry. That's the first time I've letting you take the lead. So love you. See you next week. If you like what you hear, like, subscribe, comment, engage, all of that good stuff.
Love you, Stinky.
Oh, yeah, I got to go see how Stinky's doing. All right, I'm going to hop off here.